Impact Leaders, the podcast on impact leaders, influencers, and institutions supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. And this is your host, JP Dahlman. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Trevor Nilsson as our guest. Hello, Trevor.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. No, thank you for being with us today. I just had a couple of quick thank yous. First to Diana Bianchini, owner of Dimoda PR, who for introducing us. I think that's our first link. And also to Abby Peake in your team and IX Investments and Simran Priestley at KEX CNC for coordinating the efforts to make our call possible today. And we are, in fact, rather far away from each other as we speak. I'm sitting here in a cozy lounge in England. And Trevor, I believe you are in San Francisco right now?
Santa Monica, California.
Santa Monica, perfect. So I'm very honored to be speaking with you today. I hope our listeners enjoy it as much as I'm sure I will. Like I say, real honor and real pleasure. I feel very lucky that we have this call and that we can, you know, share some of your stories and lessons, you know, with our listeners.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So to start, please allow me to share a short bio about yourself for the benefit of our listeners and as my humble way to thank you for your time and the amazing work that you do. And I will say, first of all, Trevor is the co-founder and CEO of IX Investments. Prior to launching IX Investments, he served as president of G2 Investment Group, where he helped lead the firm's initiatives in energy, real estate, and security. Before the work at G2, Trevor was co-founder of Global Philanthropy Group, an advisory firm that was sold to Todd Wagner and Charity Network in 2017. In that capacity, he has been involved in the creation and implementation of many of the world's most respected philanthropic initiatives and has worked with over 50 major philanthropies. Please bear with me. I have a lot I want to share because you have done so much. I'm not going to read everything, but I do want to share some of this. So his leadership in business and social change included time as an executive director of the Global Business Coalition, GBC, a coalition of over 200 multinational companies, which is focused on global health issues and was created with investment from Bill Gates and Ted Turner, amongst others. In this capacity, Trevor reported to the Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and President Obama's former special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Prior to his leadership of the GBC, Trevor worked closely with Bill and Melinda Gates, both in their family office and as a director of special projects and as a founding member of the team that created and launched the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where he served as a director of public affairs. Named by the World Economic Forum as Young Global Leader, Trevor served in the White House during the Clinton administration and served on the Business and Human Rights Resource Center International Advisory Network. He also serves as a co-founder and chairman of the Climate Emergency Fund and as a chairman of Las Flores Holdings, an investment firm focused on companies creating top-tier returns and measurable social impact. And to finish it off, he's active in a variety of personal philanthropic initiatives, including the climate mobilization. In the wake of the devastating California fires in 2019, Trevor co-founded the Malibu Foundation, and he was named Citizen of the Year by the Malibu Times in honor for his work following the devastating fires in Malibu and the surrounding region. What else can I say, Trevor?
That's probably too much already. I think we should leave it at that.
Let's leave it there. But I do recommend, please, for people to go and actually see, you know, more about the great work that you do. There's so much online, and I think it's very much worth it, you know, if not for inspiration, also to understand all the great things that are happening in the world that sometimes people do not know about or do not know enough. So this is our tradition. I always ask the first question to all our guests, Trevor, which is, what is impact investing?
Well, I think that there are a lot of different definitions, but at the core, it's investing in a way that seeks to generate financial returns and measurable social impact. And so there's an aspect of intentionality that's at play. But our definition is really focused on also delivering returns. So we are not in the business of making investments that have a concessionary return profile. You know, I've spent a lot of my career in philanthropy. And to me, if you're making an investment that accepts a low return or no return, that's philanthropy, not investing. And so our definition is really focused on top-tier returns and measurable social impact together.
Top returns, and that's always what investors are looking for, and we'll talk about that a bit more later. So, and about your company, I recommend everyone to go to your website, which is ix-investments.com. It says that IX Investments is an entrepreneurial multi-strategy impact investing platform, structured as a holding company addressing areas of human need. I mean, I can share quite a few of the things that I can see, but I kind of leave you the microphone to share with us more about your company.
Yeah, so IX, which I founded with Howard Warren Buffett, Warren's grandson, is a company that's owned now by 58 leading families around the world. We're a permanent capital vehicle, not a fund, structured so that all of the families participate as shareholders, not LPs. And so the structure is really meant to be a place for family offices from around the world to engage in investments that make the world a better place, but also provide them the returns that they're looking for. And we are active in a number of different areas, but almost all of them touch climate and sustainability and the overall issue around carbon emissions. So, for example, we have a commercial real estate fund. That fund is called Rising Impact. It's a partnership with a company called Rising here in Los Angeles. And Rising Impact is doing one thing and doing it very well. It's buying and greening commercial office buildings. That reduces the operating expenses of those buildings and increases the rents because you're able to, once you've greened a building, able to appeal to a new group of tenants that otherwise wouldn't be interested. And of course, if you green the building, you can make it much more energy efficient and then it costs less to operate. And buildings produce 35% of carbon emissions.
Yes.
And so this is a very impactful, very direct climate change strategy and one that targets a 15% net return for investors. And so, you know, as it relates to Rising Impact, I often say, well, you could make a charitable donation to an NGO and they'll tell you that they're going to go out and work on the climate change issue, or you can invest in Rising Impact and we can calculate for you the number of tons of carbon that we took out of the atmosphere through your investment, because there's a before and after carbon footprint for the buildings that Rising is investing in. And so commercial real estate is one area we're active in. Another area that we're active in that I'm excited about is in waste to aviation fuel. We have a company called Waste Fuel. It's using a proven technology to convert waste from cities, landfill waste, into aviation fuel. And that aviation fuel burns at an 80% reduction in carbon to fossil fuel-based aviation fuel. So, you know, when you think about the landfill crisis or the plastics crisis or the fact that we have plastic, you know, choking the life out of our oceans, well, that's a landfill problem. And if we can use that waste, use that energy to be the fuel for our aircraft, and then those aircraft are dramatically reducing their emissions, that's a big business. And so we have projects underway with Waste Fuel where we're developing biorefineries in Panama. We're also developing biorefineries in the Philippines, two countries that have really significant waste problems. And that's another good example. A third example is more of a technology play for us, which is a company called Carbon Engineering. We're invested in Carbon Engineering alongside my old boss, Bill Gates, and some others. And Carbon Engineering is a newer technology that can suck carbon directly out of the air and turn it into clean fuels. This, in many ways, is a real breakthrough in that if we can extract carbon directly out of the air and turn it into a valuable product like fuels, we can begin, you know, addressing the carbon problem in a kind of methodical way. So those are three examples of what we're doing. There's a lot more that I could talk about, but that probably gives you a general sense for what our focus is.
Yes. That last one was effectively carbon capture, right? That's what they do, and then convert it into fuels.
Yeah, capturing the carbon, but not just sequestering it, instead using it for fuels. And so this is what we call carbon to value, that carbon itself is a very valuable thing. We are just treating it as if it's not valuable and throwing it into the atmosphere in a way that has created a profound emergency globally. We have 415 parts per million of CO2 in our atmosphere now. That's the highest level of CO2 that has been in our atmosphere in at least 800,000 years. And it's leading to really terrifying extreme weather events around the world. In fact, today in Australia, there are 100,000 houses in and around Sydney that are in danger of burning down because of massive, massive wildfires that are burning there. And we're seeing this every day all around the world. And so, you know, if we don't start using the power of business to address the climate emergency, we're going to end up in a very, very scary place.
Totally. And what is interesting, which I think in all previous episodes we haven't really talked about as much, and the way that you went into it straight away into returns and the solutions, is that the combination of the different solutions for different countries and different regions is what we have to think about as well, right? It's not one solution fits all, and it's not just about complaining about fossil fuels, but just using the power of engineering, innovation, technology, and all the great things that we humans have for the solutions that we need, right?
It's true, but we also have to address fossil fuels, and we also have to address the banking and financial system that is perpetuating them. I mean, I'll give you an example. So, you know, a lot of money is made on fossil fuels, and between JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup, they financed $2 trillion in new fossil fuel projects between 2016 and 2018. Okay, $2 trillion in new projects. Now, this is at a time when the world should be very rapidly moving away from fossil fuel infrastructure and instead focusing on renewables. And yet we're not. I mean, in Japan, you have Mitsubishi financing brand new coal-fired power plants. There's 24 coal-fired power plants that have been planned just in Japan. That is insanity. You know, coal is the dirtiest of all energy sources, and we've got to address that. So, you know, we're in a very dangerous place globally now. It's a place that represents a clear present danger to us, to our children, and to their children. And so at IX, we're investing in solutions that prove that you can make a lot of money while addressing this problem, but we need more people to get involved.
Agree completely. And if you don't mind, I will come back to some of these points later on the episode. But if I try to, for the benefit again of perhaps people that can come to IX Investment as a platform, other investors, so tell me a little bit more how it works. So you have certain areas of focus, which you mentioned a couple of kind of real examples already. And you have this, so you have kind of renewable energy, you have carbon to value, which is you just mentioned, waste to energy, the green commercial real estate, and you also do also some work on gender equality, education, and media, right?
Correct, and we're in affordable housing as well, and more we've been looking at the insurance business as well. So, you know, it's not only climate and carbon, but that's a big part of our focus.
And in terms of the model, how does it work? So you mentioned before that you're actually a company, not a fund, which brings some benefits, and you very openly and share some of the returns that you're targeting. Which sometimes, you know, when you talk to funds, you know, they're not that keen or easy to talk about. And you have in total right now a certain amount of capital already that you have raised, or is it all kind of commitments and pledges?
The thing about a permanent capital structure of our kind is that we can invest at really any stage in the life of a company. So in terms of some of these companies, we are actually capitalizing them and launching them, and thus we own the majority of them. So Waste Fuel is a good example of that, where we have put millions of dollars into building this business helping develop it around the world, and we are the majority owners. Other businesses, we are more passive investors. So, for example, in carbon engineering, you know, we put $1 million into carbon engineering, buying shares from one of the founders. But, you know, we're playing a pretty passive role. The commercial real estate fund, fund one will be a $500 million fund, and we're in the middle of still raising that. And we live in the GP for that fund. So, you know, all of these structures, all of these platforms, if you will, get capitalized in different ways. But the 58 families that are a part of IX own a piece of all of them, pro rata. You know, so everything rolls up to these 58 families who are some of the most prominent families in the world. And that's the structure. And it's a little bit hard for people to understand sometimes because yes. people are so focused on funds. But the model of Berkshire Hathaway, which is the model that we are using, obviously has proven to be perhaps the most effective structure in the history of finance. And so the idea is that the leading families of the world will be at this for many years to come. We don't charge them any fees, so there's no GP or LP structure, and instead are focused on the long term, really.
I just wanted to maybe quickly highlight and just stress on some of the points that I picked up, which is worth sharing in terms of, you know, the simplicity of your model. So you mentioned you invest in companies with high potential for sustained social impact and a stable cash flow. So it says here you retain earnings to maximize your capital and reinvest, driven by long-term profits and sustained local change. You help with the acceleration of growth through the platform, and you try to measure as well the social impact, right? Of the investments. And I want to talk about the measurement specifically, maybe in the next question after the one that I'm going to ask you now. So you mentioned about the 58 families and you don't charge fees. So is this a closed group, or is if anyone wants to invest and join you? Is that
No, there's no more ability to invest in the holding company. That's come and gone. But there is an opportunity to invest in the various platforms, right? So the commercial real estate fund is being raised right now. There are still opportunities there. There's an opportunity to invest in the waste business. There's an opportunity to invest in our new affordable housing platform, which is called MultiGreen. So we have lots of places to invest, but unfortunately, it's too late to invest in the holding company overall.
I understand. And just to clarify, in terms of when you say platform, is really whatever shape and form of the vehicle that it's going to take to invest in that area, right? So let's say on the real estate is a fund. So right. It's not about like a technology platform where people can come and invest and buy through a website, right?
Right. So each of these are structured differently. We actually only have two funds. One is an early stage venture fund, and then the other is the commercial real estate fund. The other holdings are actually businesses. And so, you know, we have a great degree of flexibility in the model. We can use the structure or invest in the structure that we think makes the most sense. We'll never be an LP in a fund. So if we're involved in a fund, we're always in the GP. Because if we were in the LP, it's not conducive to our model.
I understand. And in terms of, let's say, the other investors that, you know, you're looking for, let's say, for example, on the real estate example, what type of investors are you looking for? What type of companies will be?
You know, we have a very active capital raising effort. Mm-hmm. We have an office in New York that's led by a guy named Steve Oyer. Steve came to us from Lazard and ran the family office business at Lazard, and now he runs the family office business for IX. I think for the commercial real estate fund, it's a combination of institutional investors and then family offices. You know, almost all large family offices have significant commercial real estate holdings. And then a lot of institutional investors obviously are interested in the space. So those are the two areas of focus. We are lucky in that we have built a very large network of family offices, beginning with our 58 families, but then, you know, moving out to a much broader universe. And so really with everything we do, we are talking to the leading families of the world, and then sometimes are adding institutional investors when it makes sense as well.
So, and this is interesting. So effectively, you are quite blessed because you already have a really strong network of people that don't only have the capital, but they are very conscious about what we need to do in the world to sustain it, right?
Our theory was that if we could go out and get the leading families of the world, then everything else would fall into place. And it wasn't that easy getting leading families of the world, people like, you know, co-founder of Airbnb or the Getty family or the Gaviries in Switzerland or others. But I think that the key to the whole thing is offering the return profile that people need. You know, if you go to people and you say, hey, we want you to make the world a better place and we're not sure what kind of returns we're going to get, I don't think we would have these 58 families, right? So instead, you have to build a rock solid team, which we've done. I mean, our president, Christine Harada, was the chief sustainability officer of the United States under President Obama. Per Lindstrom acts as our CIO. Per came to us from Abu Dhabi Investment Council, was at Bain prior to that. I already mentioned Steve Oyer, who runs the New York office. Steve ran the family office business for Lazard and now runs our family office business. So, you know, by assembling a hardcore team of investors and building an investment thesis that focuses on returns first, but then also really measures the social impact, it's a unique offering. But I must admit, it was not the easiest thing to go get 58 families. It did take some time. And, you know, we're not asking people to join a club. We're asking people to buy shares in IX, which they have done. But we think it's pretty unique. I don't know of anybody else that has a structure like ours in the world. And I'm quite confident that in terms of impact, it's a highly efficient structure. It's a difficult one to build. And that's why I think others haven't been able to do it. But once you build it, it can really perform very well over the long term. And the biggest reason for that is compound interest. You know, compound interest is the reason why this platform works in a way that a fund does not work. You know, compound interest is the phenomenon, obviously, of, you know, interest that is calculated on the initial principal, but includes all of the accumulated interests of every investment that's made over time. And so, you know, you can build the value of the company in an exponential way, and then eventually you can IPO. So, you know, the other thing about IX that's pretty unique is that we believe that long term we will IPO the overall business, at which point we'll have done something really historic, I think, because we would be the very first publicly traded finance company that combines top tier returns with measurable social impact. You know, that doesn't exist in the world today. And so that's where we're headed. And a fund can't do that. Our structure can. And so I actually kind of enjoy the fact that people don't understand it, because it tells me that we're doing something that's really unique.
You mentioned that it wasn't easy. So what was kind of the biggest challenge or the biggest challenges you faced to put it all together?
Well, you know, first is coming up with the idea overall. That's probably the hardest part. Then assembling the right team, and then really going out and educating the leading families of the world on this structure. Now, the fact that it bears some similarities to Berkshire Hathaway is helpful, because people, you know, leading families definitely understand Berkshire Hathaway. But there's only so many similarities, right? I mean, they've been around for 60 years. Their focus is very different. We're not Berkshire Hathaway, but at least people can understand that structure is being one where there are shareholders, not LPs. But it's amazing how many times people refer to us as a fund, even though we've gone through an hour-long conversation about what we're doing. People are just really trained to think about finance in terms of funds. So, you know, I think probably the hardest part was coming up with the idea. The second hardest part was probably raising the initial capital that we raised. We've raised two rounds of capital, one a friends and family round, and then one a Series A. Both of those went very well. We were oversubscribed for our Series A, and, you know, it was a success. But, you know, when you have something that's a brand new structure, it's just a matter of educating people, and that can be a process.
And you mentioned, so there is, well, by the way, interesting. So I had a really good call with Christina Harada before, and we talked about, you know, all the things that you said. And interesting enough, I must admit that I still went away with the concept of the fun. You know, it's, and I'm sharing that. I've been very open because, you know, even though I wrote it down that it wasn't that, it's, the brain wants to take away that concept, it seems. But then I keep reading that actually it is a company that is just...
It is a company, yeah. And there are shareholders.
Permanently capitalized holding company. That's the key. That's the key.
Yeah. And, you know, that phrase is somewhat confusing too, right? But the easiest way to think about it is it's just a company. It's a company that has shareholders. And, you know, liquidity in a permanent capital structure like ours can really come in two or three forms. So, you know, one would be you can pay distributions to people. You know, distribute profits if you want. You can, you know, be acquired by another company, or you can IPO, and at which point there would be a significant liquidity event for the 58 families, obviously depending upon market conditions and, you know, everything else. But that's very different than a fund, right? All a fund can really do is return investment profits back to the people that are its LPs. You know, a fund can't IPO because there's no inherent value in a fund, unlike in a finance company of our kind.
I was going to touch just one last time around the messaging, and you mentioned about educating. Obviously, you're very clear that, you know, wealthy families, you know, talk business and you talk returns. So that's the first thing. What else did you have to kind of change in your messaging to touch, you know, their pockets and their wallets in a way?
Well, I think that they want to know what the track record is of the team. So you have to build a team that they have confidence in. That obviously requires cash, right? So you have a little bit of a chicken and egg problem.
Yeah.
In that, you know, in order to hire the team that people have confidence in, you need capital, right? And so there's a little bit of a balancing act there. I will tell you, one of our secrets at IX, which maybe I shouldn't share so broadly, is that, you know, we incentivize people with equity. So everybody that works for the company has equity in the company, and that is their primary form of incentive. We're, you know, we pay fair salaries, but this is not a Wall Street firm where, you know, every new year people are getting huge cash bonuses and going out and buying Ferraris. Mm-hmm. You know, it's structured in the same way that a technology company is usually structured, in that people are granted equity in IX, and that equity becomes more and more valuable the higher the valuation of the company goes. And so, you know, that way of incentivizing people, I think, creates better results long term because they're acting in the interests of the shareholders. And that's the way we're structured. You know, if you visited us here in Santa Monica, California, you would see something that looks a lot like a technology company. We're not trying to be like other people in finance. Our name is different. Our focus is different. Our structure is different. We're not trying to become the next BlackRock or Goldman Sachs or UBS or Carlyle or JP. We're trying to build something new. And we're building it in a way that we believe acknowledges that, you know, investors more and more want to align their investments with their values. And more people believe that capitalism needs to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. And younger investors in particular are not willing to have their investments used in a way that destroys, you know, biodiversity on our planet, that pollutes our air, that pushes more carbon into the atmosphere, you know, that preys upon, you know, poor people. You know, they're just not willing. They don't want their investments to pay for gun companies or for opiate manufacturers or for mining companies that destroy, you know, fragile ecosystems. So, you know, we're something new. We're not looking to be like the old people, because we think the old people have really caused some serious problems in this world. And so the fact that it's a little bit hard for people to understand doesn't bother me, because it shows that they're just trying to get their head around the notion that capitalism can actually make the world a better place. And I think that most of us have been trained to think that it cannot, you know, that capitalism is exploitive in nature, that capitalism has to be harmful in order to profit. And we absolutely reject that notion. We think that it's time for a new era in capitalism. And I think that there are a lot of other people that agree.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that. You mentioned as well, as you went through the kind of educational process, you had to talk about identifying and measuring impact. And perhaps at this point, I wanted to mention that, you know, with your co-founder, with Howard W. Buffett, he's kind of leading the efforts on the social value investing framework, which is his framework, right? So did you have to share that as well? Did investors care, for that matter, about it? Or yeah. Is it just something that you added on top?
You know, I think that they care, but what they really want to know is that there is a system in place to measure the impact, and that there are serious people who have a track record in impact that are monitoring it. I actually have not had many people want to go really deep into the measurement methodology. It's more they see who's in charge of it and they see that it's serious, and then they feel confidence in it. In fact, I think that the impact space has spent too much time thinking deep thoughts about measurement and debating it at conferences and writing papers about it. And, you know, this never ending debate about how to measure impact, I think in many ways has created an excuse for people to not actually take action. We don't need more deep thoughts about how to measure impact. We need trillions of dollars of capital going into investments that address the biggest problems we have. So I think that the academic analysis of impact can really act in a negative way to freeze people up from taking action that actually matters. So yes, we have a very serious system in place. Yes, Howard is unequivocally one of the leading thinkers, if not the leading thinker in the world, on how to measure impact through his impact rate of return methodology. But I think that all of us need to move to action, you know, because we're running out of time.
I agree with you. And it's interesting, just like you say, most of the people, investment managers, mainly investors on the podcast, tend to say something similar, which is, let's just focus on taking action and let's try to work out how we can actually measure it as well, but not kind of stop just trying to work out what the measurement is before we actually do something about it.
Well, yeah, or if you're one of these banks that's just, you know, put $5 trillion into financing fossil fuel projects, how about you just stop doing that? You know, even if you wanted to do nothing positive, you could just focus on stopping doing things that are negative and you could make a big impact, you know? And so, look, we're way past the point of people doing things a little bit better or people trying to be a little less bad. We have a global emergency on our hands. And the estimate that I always remember from the International Energy Agency, when the Paris Climate Accord was signed, the IEA came out and said, we need $15 trillion in private sector capital, trillion with a T, in order to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accord. Now, most people didn't even focus on that because they were focused on, you know, well, what countries have signed the Paris Climate Accord? Are they going to adhere to the terms? Is America's crazy president going to withdraw, you know, and all that. But it was what was overlooked is that you need $15 trillion of private sector capital to transition from a dirty energy economy to a clean energy economy. And currently that capital is not in the system. So we need to get that capital in the system. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to make that transition that we need in order to, you know, save humanity from a really dark and terrifying place.
So, and as we talk about then, you know, the future, the present and the future, you know, you do have this phrase as well in your website saying that the potential is staggering So what is it that you think we can do to really scale more IX investment, capitalized companies type of players coming into the industry? Or, I mean, you mentioned obviously some of the big banks changing the way they allocate their investments. What else can we do, you think, that can really make the change?
I think that there's a combination of things. You know, one is that, you know, elect leaders that are committed to addressing the climate emergency and addressing it in an aggressive way. You know, number one. I mean,
That's quite a subject, yes.
It is. We need elected leaders around the world that are going to address this emergency, number one. Number two, as a consumer or as an investor, you have to make the choice that you are going to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem, right? And so, you know, you have a choice where you're investing. You have a choice what products and services you're consuming. That would be, I think, another necessary thing for people to do. A third would be to support the activist groups that are out demanding that society address this problem with the seriousness that it deserves. And so whether it's Greta Thunberg and the student strikers around the world, or on the more aggressive side of things, it's Extinction Rebellion or Greenpeace or others, you know, I think that those activists deserve our respect. Yes. Because they are out fighting to save humanity. And on occasion, some of their tactics are inconvenient for people. You know, if Extinction Rebellion shuts down London and makes it harder for people to get around, that might be frustrating to them. But it may be that we need a little bit of frustration in order to get ourselves focused on the fact that we have a real emergency on our hands. And, you know, this is where Europe is ahead of the United States. At least in European capitals, you have, you know, more attention being paid to the climate emergency. The United States is way behind on this and is also, of course, the second biggest emitter of carbon in the world after China. And so, and I think that supporting the activists is something that all of us should do. And of course, I've tried to do that philanthropically through the Climate Emergency Fund. The final thing I think that people can do is to really just decide that this is their problem and not somebody else's. You know, it is very easy with the climate emergency to sit on the sidelines and say, well, I'm a little bit worried about it, but I'm not really going to do anything about it. I'm going to let somebody else do something about it. And of course, if we all take that position, then no one ever does anything about it. And that's been the situation that we have been in. I mean, we've put more carbon into the atmosphere in the last 30 years than we put into the atmosphere in the preceding 300 years. You know, at the very time when we should be completely transitioning the way we live, we continue to pump as much carbon into the atmosphere as we possibly can. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think that there's a need for people to make a personal commitment on a variety of levels to addressing the problem if we're going to have any hope of addressing it.
And I mean, we can go on this subject for a long time, but again, conscious of time, obviously we have all the events happening in Hong Kong, in London, there's some events happening in South America. I mean, most people must have seen all the problems in Chile right now. And obviously, the U.S. is starting to withdraw from the agreement that's happened, started happening this week, I think. And there is a whole challenge around trust between the people and the elected government. So quite a mix.
There's a government, with the possible exception of New Zealand, I'm not sure that there's a government in the world that is addressing the climate emergency with the seriousness that it deserves. Not one. I think that there are individual actions here and there that are encouraging. You know, Germany has said that they're moving completely away from coal. That's helpful. You know, the UK, you know, the parliament did declare a climate emergency nationally for the UK, which was very exciting. But that now has to be followed with really specific plans. You know, the Chinese have done a good job of, you know, investing in renewables and pushing hard, but they still are operating far too many coal-fired plants and are massive polluters. And the Indians have taken a similar approach. They've actually done less than the Chinese, and that's very concerning as well. So I think it's very hard to find examples of governments doing what needs to be done. And that's why people have to stand up and demand it, you know, and slowly but surely that's happening, but it needs to happen at a much larger scale, I think.
So as we start kind of coming to the end, I didn't want to go away without asking a little bit about you. I mean, there's so much I would like to ask you, but, you know, we only have maybe 5 more minutes. But I have seen that you have had quite a path, you know, to get to where you are. And I've heard about, you know, the kind of the launch of, you know, IX Investment as your kind of ultimate action right now to trying to make this change. Was there something in particular that happened, you know, when you, that you decided to launch IX Investment? Or was it a conversation with Howard?
Well, you know, I've known Howard since he's in college, and he and I have done a lot of work together philanthropically. But I think that for me, you know, if I think about how I can use my time in life to make the world better, and if I think about my 3 kids and the sort of world that I want them to grow up in and live in long after I'm gone, then logically brings me to what, you know, an analysis of what skills I have and how I can use those skills. And probably because I worked for Bill Gates and worked for Bill Clinton, I've always been around, you know, the wealthy people of the world and saw an opportunity to get them pointed in a new and better direction. You know, family offices control about $5 trillion of wealth. Probably more than that, but that's the estimate that people use. And, you know, if we can get a couple $1 trillion of that wealth pointing in this new direction, well, that's a pretty profound impact for the world. And if simultaneously we can get institutional investors and even retail investors saying that they refuse to have their capital be used in a way that harms the planet, and instead would like their capital to be used in a way that proactively helps the planet, then to me, that's a huge success. And so there wasn't any one individual moment that I think that, you know, that made me want to start IX. I think
one individual person either, right? So it's collective.
No, more a combination of things. I mean, listen, I'm a student of science. I read science and I believe science. I believe, you know, there's now 20 or 30,000 scientists that have signed this emergency climate declaration. I believe them. And, you know, I live in a place in Malibu that's been impacted by these terrible fires. I see the impact of the climate emergency locally where I live. And so I want to use whatever time and whatever resources I have to try to help address that. And I believe that capital and capitalism is a huge part of the problem. You know, capital at the end of the day is energy, right? So you can think of a dollar as a unit of energy, because if you give it to something good, good things happen. If you give it to something bad, bad things happen. So, you know, if you view capital as the transfer of energy, then you pretty quickly find yourself saying, well, then is there a way to influence the way that energy is transferred? Is there a way to give energy to positive solutions in the world instead of negative solutions and make money at the same time? I mean, I love making money. Yeah. I am very supportive of making money, and all of our shareholders see it the same way. So that's a little bit about the philosophy of where it came from. Mm-hmm. And I think our timing is right. It seems like the world now is really focused on this in the way that we hoped they would get focused on it. And, you know, we're ahead of most people, I think, and it's great to see people catching up.
Yes. I didn't want to finish without mentioning, I happened to kind of invert the commas coincidentally watch the documentary on called Bill's Brain, which is a documentary. And it's going back to the point about educating. What really amazed me about that documentary, which is about Bill's a bit of the life and the initiatives that he's taking with the foundation, with his wife, Melinda. And what really shocked me was that somebody with such an intelligence and such an amazing life and so much kind of awareness and knowledge, still with all of that and the capital, still actually he didn't know about most of the things that he started to find out that were the issues in the world that then he started working on. So people just don't know, even at the again highest level, right?
And you know, Bill is obviously an incredible leader and remarkable human being, but he came up in a system which is the same system we all came up in, where he, you know, he was focused on building a company. He had said to himself that he was going to wait to be a philanthropist till the end of his life, you know, build a company, make a lot of money, then give it away later. And then he realized that he really should start sooner because the world had incredible problems and has incredible problems that he could make an impact on. So what a perfect example, you know, of someone, wealthiest person in the world, initially thought that they would wait to do philanthropy until they retire, but then got aggressively focused on philanthropy in his 40s. And now look at the result. I mean, it's been remarkable to see what he's done. And so I hope that others, people like Jeff Bezos and others, can go through a similar transition, because the world needs these people.
Completely agree. And on that note, I mean, you have worked with some, you know, incredible people. And we talk, you know, the name of the podcast is Impact Leaders. So we tend to ask the people that we interview, what do you think makes an impact leader or a genius top leader like the ones that you have worked with?
Action. You know, action. I don't think that going to Davos and being on a panel really means anything. I don't think making small charitable donations really means anything. I think that deciding that you are going to use the power you have as a leader in a deep and sustained way to address the problems we face is what is admirable. And I think that we get confused a lot. You know, people think, well, if somebody gives a great inspiring speech, or somebody goes to TED, let's say they give a great TED talk. Well, we've somehow confused the notion that a great TED talk creates any real impact in the world. It does not. So we don't need to inspire people. We need to create real world change. So the greatest impact leaders, in my view, are the people that move way beyond TED Talks or going to Davos or putting out a report or whatever, and instead create real world change. We don't have time for anything else. And so that to me is the definition of leadership.
Fantastic. And just inspired on what you are doing and also on what Bill has been doing and is doing right now, I would add to that, which is bringing people together and bringing this incredible team of people together, which I realize now how you build IX Investment. And even in this case, Bill is trying to do to recreate a nuclear power, which blew my mind, by the way. It's quite something. Action with others, right? You cannot do things on your own.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, thanks for having me on. Yeah. It's been a good conversation.
No, thank you very much. If there's any way that people can reach you or IX Investment, the best way is through the website, I would say.
Yeah, it's all on the website, and people can reach out if they're interested in getting involved.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Trevor.
All right. Thanks for having me. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So thank you so much, everyone, for listening to our episode today. It is bye for now, and until our next episode of Impact Leaders, God bless you all. And please remember to check out partners' websites for upcoming events.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.